Good afternoon, everybody. This is Jeff J. Brown, China Rising Radio, sign of land on the D-Day beaches of Normandy. And I'm going back to one of my favorite cities 7 hours earlier than me here in France, to the windy city of Chicago. And I am honored and pleased to have on the show today, Ramin Mazahiri. How are you doing, Ramin?
Doing good, doing good. Thanks for having me, Jeff. Big fan for many, many years.
Well, and likewise, we are here today to discuss a book of his that I just read and just fell in love with. But let me give you his quick bio. Ramin Mazahiri is a Paris-based journalist, columnist, and author. He studied print journalism and history at the University of Missouri, fluent in multiple languages. He has been a daily newspaper reporter in the U.S., worked in French radio and reported from Iran, Cuba, Egypt's Tahrir Square, Tunisia, South Korea, and elsewhere. He has been the chief correspondent for Press TV in Paris for well over a decade. He is the author of Socialism's Ignored Success, the Iranian Islamic Socialism, and I have the book right here.
Beautiful. Thank you.
I actually bought it, and I'm really, really looking forward to reading it. And I got to go back to his bio and his other book, The France's Yellow Vests: Western Repression of the West's Best Values, English and French. I bought this too. This is the one that we're going to be talking about today, which just blew me away. I have not read this one yet, but I'm going to read this one next. And then his first book. I'll ruin everything you are, ending Western propaganda on Red China. There's English and Chinese versions, both simplified and traditional. That's quite impressive. Of course, the Yellow Vest book is also in French and in English. So welcome to the show, Ramin. Really, really, really excited to talk about your book.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Great to be here.
All right. Ramin's book is essentially connecting the revolution of the French Revolution of 1789 to today's Yellow Vests, and so it's a wonderful synthesis. The first half of the book is all about up to the Yellow Vests, and then the last half of the book is about the Yellow Vests. And so we're going to start off with and I learned so much I had no idea. And I don't think most of the French had any idea either because of all of the propaganda. So let's start with the French Revolution. Why is the French Revolution of 1789 so fundamental to global history?
All right. Well, just to go back a bit about the structure of the book and how I got there, I think, you know, some people might find it interesting. First of all, I'm thrilled that you like it. That's great. You know, you have an extensive knowledge about France. You're there now. So that really, really says a lot that, you know, if you enjoy it and it passes your muster, that's that's one of the best compliments I can get, truly. The way that I set it up is that because I have been the reporter that attended more Yellow Vest demonstrations than any other reporter in English or French, thanks to my daily hard news journalism for Press TV, I thought I should write a history of the Yellow Vests and to analyze the movement. And then I said, okay, well, I'll go back and I'll talk about the Macron and Hollande era and the era of austerity. And, you know, I'll just go back to 2008. And, you know, this is kind of where this all started, 2009, rather, with the start of the Lisbon Treaty, which really put the EU into force. And then I realized you have to go back further than that, you know, because what's needed for France is not just a debunking of the propaganda on the Yellow Vests. You have to go back through all of their periods of progressive revolutionary history. And France is just so very exceptional in that you can go back to 1789. You can go back to 1815. You can go back to 1848. You can go back to 1871. And they are at the absolute forefront of progressive politics, just like the Yellow Vests were. So that's why the scope of this book really sort of expanded beyond the Yellow Vests It's really to show how the Yellow Vests and the EU are a bookend to a long process which involves liberal democracy as opposed to socialist democracy. It's a bookend to liberal democracy, the EU, the Yellow Vests, and it goes back to 1789. And there's just, I think, you know, you will probably agree with, there's just so much nonsense. There's so much Western propaganda about progressive politics everywhere, whether it's in China, whether it's in Iran, and even when it's inside the West itself. So this book is, you know, the first half of the book is really a lot of ending Western propaganda on revolutionary France. And that's 1789, that's 1850, that's 1789, that's 1830, 1848, 1871, the Paris Commune. These are all dates which don't have a lot of meaning to people, but, you know, because they're not really celebrated, but more rather repressed, and there's a lot of propaganda around them. But these are dates which are extremely important to France, and they're also then extremely important to Europe, to European history, and to the West. And when we look at the French Revolution as sort of as truly, truly starting modern politics, we see how just France, you know, I'm trying to be a objective journalist, which is what I was trying to do. France just has this tremendous history of progressive politics that other countries simply do not, and certainly in the West. And this is just sort of a fact of history. Some countries, you know, at certain periods of time are just more, you know, open to progressive ideas than others. Iran would be another one of them. And hopefully that book, when you read that one, it's going to really debunk for you all the Western propaganda on the Islamic Revolution of 1979 and how that fits in with progressive politics, which began in 1789. So that's why this book became two parts: French history debunking so many things, which we can talk about, and then the second part, you know, you can almost say it starts with the history of 2009 up to the Yellow Vest and analyzing it, and really thoroughly analyzing the Yellow Vest. So it's sort of an unusual book in that way. So to answer your question, why is the French Revolution so fundamental to global history? You know, I think that we can just talk about the French Revolution, you know, in terms of its enemies. The best way to put it is that from 1789, or rather 1791 until 1815, 24 years, every single country in Europe fought what I call the seven coalition wars to end the French Revolution. France was, in 1789, they were opposed by absolutely everybody in Europe. And we are talking about for 25 years, with only really one year off, where just like Iran today, just like Cuba today, just like China was until you know, Nixon, they were subject to war and sanctions and any effort to restore the previous reactionary status quo, which was you know, absolute monarchy. So we're talking about decades of war, of sanctions, all in an effort to restore basically just oligarchy. I mean, that's really what it comes down to: absolute monarchy, oligarchy, neo-aristocracy, the 1%. This is really what it is. There's really only two poles. There's really a sort of I see a, you know, binary reality when it comes to politics. You either have democracy, which is the rule of the many, or you have autocracy, oligarchy, the rule of the very few. And that's what France in 1789, as opposed to the U.S. in 1776, France explicitly rejected this type of oligarchy. But, you know, the French Revolution being so important in 1789, just look at its enemies. 24 years of war against it, war against the fight of the French people to do what? To end feudalism, to end slavery. And what could have been more progressive than that in 1789? And also very, very key, you know, the idea of constitutionalism, the idea that when you were calling for a constitution in 1789, they were going to throw you in jail all over Europe. This seems totally absurd to us today, but we have to realize just how revolutionary it really was. So I think that one thing that this book really tries to, you know, point out is how Western historiography tries to split this 24-year period into two different eras. You have, for them, the French Revolutionary Wars, and then as soon as Napoleon comes on the scene, you have the Napoleonic Wars. That's a completely incorrect way to view these things. And, you know, a lot of these, you know, things I just say, you know, you have to read the book. But, you know, because they say the reason that they feel justified to do that is that Napoleon became consul for life and then he became emperor. But the major difference is, and my book talks about this, and it really puts the emphasis on it, because that's where I believe it should be, is that this guy was elected consul for life. 7 million people. Nobody had any votes for 7 million people back when he was elected consul for life. A couple of years later, he was constantly being, there were assassination attempts. There were by pro-monarchists. And if you look at the book, and I cite top French sources. He became emperor, to satisfy the monarchy, to end the Civil War. People loved monarchy so much back then. It was all they knew. So he accepted to be elected emperor for life. And that's really the key word. I mean, we have to go back, to the fact that back in 1789, back in the early 19th century, then when Napoleon came around, there were no elected leaders anywhere in Europe. They were hereditary, theocratic monarchies. And we cannot take the French Revolution for granted. We have to say, whoa, that's really blowing my mind. I'm putting myself back in, 1790. What a radical thing that they were doing to get away with unelected, hereditary, theocratic monarchies. That's what most of the West is today. Only most. You still have 25% of the EU is still monarchical. So the book talks more about it, but just for your viewers and listeners, Napoleon taking the title of consul and emperor, these were mere forms. And this is not my opinion. This is what many people, many top historians in France say. It's just not something that gets popularized. And the point is that it does not end the French Revolution, because, what we are talking about is the end of absolute monarchy. And that's what the French Revolution really got away from, ending absolute monarchy and creating a constitution. So this idea that inherited monarchy is absolutely wrong and should be consigned to the dustbin of history, this is something that it took a long time to spread. This would be a battle for the entire 19th century. This is something that it would take World War I, the bloodletting of World War I, to finally, reduce the power of these autocratic monarchies. And this is something that France did in 1789. So it's something that is just, it's something that people kind of really don't understand. And this is one of the main things of the book. And I think it's, coming from, being an Iranian citizen and being, supporting the 1979 Islamic Revolution. I think that Iranians are very sort of, we're both at the forefront and also behind, in that we understand the problem is autocracy. The problem is monarchy. And this is something which I think the West and liberal democracy does not understand. This is where liberal democracy and socialist democracies, where they make a split. But this book, my book here, it talks a lot about how, what is Emmanuel Macron today but an autocrat when he is ruling by decree, the 49-3 executive order? when he is doing that, and people are okay with it, it shows. You know, when he is admired for, you know, acting like an autocrat, when people are, you know, think it's cool that he's, you know, King Jupiter, this is the legacy of autocracy. And it goes back to 1788, and it wasn't until 1789 that the people started to finally get into the idea of democracy. And we have gone, you know, on certain levels. We've had liberal democracy, we've had socialist democracy, but the least amount of democracy, where it's limited to a small, you know, coterie, a small oligarchy, it's limited to the 1%, that's what autocracy really is. And this is really, it's so fundamental, you know, in global history, because it's moving away, 1789 moves us away from the power of a king or a queen to the masses. But we have to make this link to today of how France is being ruled autocratically by Macron and, you know, so blatantly. But let's not forget that François Hollande, he also ruled by decree as well. And that's not acceptable. That's not democratic. You know, I mean, one of the quotes I have in there, I believe it was, and I remember it was from one of the LFS who's the most prominent. He lost his eye, and it's in there. And he said, you know, Macron is trying to give lessons on politics to people like Venezuela when he's acting like an autocrat. So to go back to what I was saying about the unique perspective of the modern Iranian is that we, you know, that's the last great contemporary revolution of our time. But we're also waving the flag, autocracy, no, monarchy, no. But in the West, you have, republics where the leader is an autocrat like France. And then you have constitutional monarchies where aristocrats have enormous influence economically, backdoor politically in a quarter of Europe. So that's what a big part of this book is showing, how the Yellow Vests today are fighting very much something similar in 1789, where they're trying to move away from autocracy. That's really one of the main books. And I think it's the Yellow Vests really make it very, very clear. And one thing that I do, you know, talking about the French Revolution in this book, I don't go back and I don't talk about the great, you know, how great leftists they were. Robespierre, Danton, Marat, Gracchus-Babeuf. I don't talk about that. What I do is I talk about how it compares with England and the United States, because I'm saying that it's the start of modern politics, because the Glorious Revolution of England in 1688, that's not the start of modern politics, but that's what the English want you to believe. The anti-imperialist revolution of the United States, 1776, that's not the start of modern global history, but that's what the US wants you to believe. No. And this is something that, you know, most of the world accepts. It's 1789, because in England in 1688 and in the U.S. in 1776, they went from an absolute. These two things are important. I'm not saying that they're nothing, but they devolved power from an absolute monarch down to a small oligarchy in England, and that's not really democracy. I mean, you know. And then you look at the United States. That is a big advance. It's an anti-imperialist change, but it was really a coup, because it was almost all the same people were in power. And of course, you still had slavery. So when I talk about the leftism of the French Revolution, I wanted to do it in a different way. And I compared it mainly with the main inspiration of 1776, the Glorious Revolution of England of 1688, which people don't really kind of know about as well as they should, because the Bill of Rights of 1688 is almost a carbon copy of the Bill of Rights of the United States of 1776. And neither of these can be compared with the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen of 1789. So, you know, talking about why the French Revolution is the start of modern politics, we can, you know, it becomes very clear. And what it did is it ended feudalism. But it took so long for feudalism, for this idea to spread that feudalism is bad. I mean, the Germanic areas, you know, it took them, you know, as history shows, decades for them to do this. But the French were, you know, the first people to do this. But the last thing is that the French Revolution said that everybody, not just the oligarchs of the Eastern Seaboard in the United States, of the British Isles, that everybody needs to be involved in democracy. We cannot have autocracy anymore. We have to expand it out. So that started all with 1789. I'm sorry, but one last thing I have to point out is that constitutionalism, this was a revolutionary idea. England does not have a constitution. They have a series of precedents in the 1688 Bill of Rights. So this is to get into the mindset of what was a leftist revolutionary in 1789. It was constitutionalism, calling for a constitution, limiting the power of a king, creating a parliament. This is all something that on the continent was totally verboten. It was totally, from Russia all the way to Spain. If you did this, you were a radical. And that's what French revolutionaries were. They wanted a constitution so they could end feudalism. And this is something that, Napoleon did. But that's really, this is where 1789 is really where this all starts. This idea of codified rights for, everybody. And unfortunately, in 1789, it was only males who got the right to vote. But that was a huge step. Nobody had the right to vote. Kings were unelected. That changed immediately with Napoleon and then, later on as well. So it's for all these reasons, 1789 is the actual start of modern political history. 1789 contains both some of the very key seeds of liberal democracy, but also socialist democracy. So that's where it all splits from. It's not being ethnocentric, as somebody who's lived in France for, 13 years. It's not being Western-centric. This is really sort of where it started. But of course, France was just a part. The U.S. had an important part. Haiti had an important part. So, but really, 1789 is the place to start, and not with England or the United States.
Yeah. I think actually, because of all the, I think the French elites were so worried that the French people today might actually, learn about who Napoleon really was and what he did. They have just literally destroyed his reputation in this, in education and schools and books and history books. Because that's actually my next question. I was surprised to learn that Napoleon Bonaparte was, in fact, for me, a socialist, not the megalomaniac warmonger that the big lie propaganda machine has turned him into over the centuries. It reminds me of Michael Parenti's great lecture about Julius Caesar. The Senate's mafia families did not kill him for being a tyrant. No, which is what we all think today. They killed him because he too was socialist. He was giving land to the poor and lowering taxes on the poor and raising taxes on the rich. And please tell us about the real Napoleon. Who would know that he was voted into office twice?
Well, that's a great comparison with Parenti's famous analysis of Caesar, and that Caesar was, going to give rights to the slaves. And the Roman Empire was like the third or fourth biggest slave empire ever. It's really in that vein. I mean, when you're talking about how badly they have gone after Napoleon, when you learn about what he actually did, you see that, oh my gosh, they actually went after, they tar and slander and libel Napoleon the same way they do for Mao or Castro or Khomeini. Yeah. I mean, it's really so amazing. And, the one thing that I can say, or anybody can say, to just immediately shut down these ideas that he was a power-hungry tyrant, is that he was voted in. And this is at a time when a vote was totally unheard of anywhere in Europe. I mean, you want to, I mean, people want to say that it's fake news, that there wasn't a vote, that 7 million people, you know, voting for him didn't matter. This, I mean, you just can't say that, because this was a revolutionary act to hold a vote, to say that, you know, power comes from public approval, comes from public opinion, not from divine right, for, you know, some, you know, you know, you know, theocracy. Definitely, I would say that for me, writing about Napoleon was probably my most favorite chapter, because he's just such a compelling figure, because he is embodying the entire French Revolution, 25 years. You know, like I said, they want to divide up the French Revolution. It ended with Napoleon. It's just, it's really totally wrong. And, you know, it's, you have to read the book. I don't want to go on for, you know, too long, but, you know, the title of the chapter really, you know, kind of, I really sums it up, I think. Western political history doesn't make any sense if Napoleon is not a leftist. If we don't look at Napoleon as a leftist from his era, everything just kind of, you know, then what was 1789 about? I mean, nothing, things fit into place when we realize that Napoleon was a leftist of his time. He was a progressive, you know, and, you know, you kind of have to read the book, but the failure is really to realize that, you know, demanding a constitution, wanting to abolish feudalism, this is what a revolutionary was in 1789. I mean, they weren't even talking about, you know, free education and free healthcare until, you know, the, you know, mid-1790s. So, you know, when the king is finally judged and executed, that's only 1791. So we have to kind of, you know, we have to kind of realize what, you know, what was possible then, you know? I mean, you know, for example, it was not possible to get women the vote then. And that's totally wrong, you know, by today's standards, but they weren't even giving men the, you know, the right to vote. They weren't giving anyone the right to vote. They weren't giving anyone a constitution. So, you know, and when you read this book, I think I kind of make it clear that the revolutions of, you know, 1848, that's just the ideas of 1789 becoming commonplace, you know. So we're talking about several generations of Europeans who are resisting progressive politics embodied in the idea of no to absolute monarchy, yes to a parliament, yes to a constitution. And these are all things that, you know, that they were ensured that they were, that they existed in the second half of the French Revolutionary era, thanks to Napoleon. So I can go on and on about Napoleon's leftist bona fides. They are in the book.
It's really amazing. I mean, you know, sometime I would love for you and I to do a comparative discussion with between Napoleon Bonaparte and Mao Zedong, because I kept reading all this stuff and I was going, but this is what Mao did. And you would write about, but this is what Mao did. You know, this is what Mao did. You know, education, infrastructure, you know, supporting small business, you know, small business people, you know, hospitals, you know, it's just like giving at the time it was as best as he could do, you know, giving all men, not just landowners, but like the aristocracy, giving all men over, I think it was 18, or the right to vote for, like, in referenda, et cetera, trying to keep the peace with, you know, and just like Mao, just constantly, just never had a second of peace. They were just constantly being attacked and attacked. And of course, as you pointed out, England was there with their money and their gunpowder and their soldiers, you know, to
pay off
all the countries surrounding France to try to destroy the revolution. So England was the one that was involved in all seven of the, and I love your name, the what did you call it, the Continental they weren't the Napoleon's Wars. What do you call it? Oh, the
Seven Wars and the seven European wars to end the French Revolution. I mean, that's really the best way to put it. And it treats all 24 years as one block, as opposed to trying to break it up. But going back to what you said about Napoleon, I mean, as I recall, education was the biggest expenditure. And this is during times of war. You talked about building infrastructure. You talked about, giving people the right to vote. Well, he was the first one to do that. How can we not, admire someone who does this? It's because we have ceded the view of Napoleon to his enemies, the Germanic autocrats and the English oligarchs. But it's just amazing. Like you're saying, I mean, there's just so much we need to sort of end the propaganda. I mean, one thing that I talk about is, the French Napoleonic Code. I mean, many people have heard of it. It's influenced everyone all over the world. But it's not the Napoleonic Code. It's the French Revolutionary Code. It was not something autocratically created and decreed by Napoleon. No, this was the end of feudalism. This was the result of more than 10 years of work, and it's just a way, the whole great manism. I mean, I was hoping, you remember what I was talking about. I mean, it's so when I said that you want to talk about his military genius to storm a bridge under fire. Oh, what a military genius. No, it's the revolutionary spirit that won those wars, not Napoleon's genius. It was these serfs who were doing anything to not go back to feudalism. Isn't that something that, I thought that it's just talking about Napoleon's military genius. He has all of these committed, revolutionary fighters, these willing martyrs.
Just like Mao.
Yeah.
Just Ayatollah Khomeini.
Just like Iran, right? I mean,
People willing to be a martyr for a higher cause.
One thing.
It's pretty amazing. I would just encourage people to read the book because the French today are brainwashed too. They have been totally educated into the idea that he was a bloodthirsty tyrant, a terrorist, a dictator, who war hungry, warmonger. All of that after the last 200 years has just been embedded into the minds of the French. And I guarantee you, you like to joke that my book, The Big Red Book on China, should be the textbook to learn about China. Your book about the Yellow Vests ought to be the textbook to learn about French history, because what the French are being taught is basically the autocratic elite, dictatorial version of who Napoleon was, and not the real Napoleon. So it's really, really shocking. I've actually brought up a few points about Napoleon from your book, and the French are like looking at me like, really?
They don't know.
They're just getting the very filtered, anti-French Revolution, anti-progressive, anti-socialist, anti-for the people. And of course, as we know, France is still ruled by the 1%. So
if I can just, jump in there, just one thing. My book talks about that, when this changed, and it was with the restoration of liberalism in the late 70s, early 80s. That they got away from the Marxist popular point of view of Napoleon. This was the most compelling figure of the 19th century. And you're right, there are so many people in France who don't know these basic things. And it's really, really surprising. But I would say that the average French person, and I've asked so many of them over 13 years, the average French person knows in his or her heart that Napoleon was great for France. But it's, as this book talks about, in the late 70s, 80s, 90s, and now, they have started to inculcate you know, this idea that Napoleon was some sort of, you know, bloodthirsty monster. And this is to cede the view of Napoleon to his enemies, who are totally against a constitution, totally against you having a vote. So, you know, this book, it's Napoleon is just such a fascinating figure, but he's fascinating because of the French Revolution is so fascinating. He's so successful and awesome because the French Revolution was so successful and awesome. He, you know, the, you know, French Revolution was at, you know, the French, you know, empire, French Revolutionary Empire, it reached its height purely as the result of defensive wars and territories that went willingly over to the French Revolution. So there's just so much there, Jeff. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like you in China. There's just so much there which proves the bona fides of the Chinese Communist Party, of Mao. And it's just a matter of, we have to write more books and have more articles and, you know, talk about it more. But it's too bad because France is right there for the West to grab and to embrace. But the oligarchies, the 1% everywhere, they're going to always push these people down. Khomeini, Castro, Mao, Napoleon, even.
Ho Chi Minh, Kim Song-il, and all the other great leaders that... All right.
Okay, one last thing. I have to say this. I think this is important for you. On Napoleon, I didn't put it in the book. You know, the idea, you know, I did talk in the book about how there is a normal political spectrum, and then there's a revolutionary political spectrum, okay? And now Napoleon was not on the far left. He was not a diehard Jacobin, but he was definitely not on the right, where he was a monarchist. He was in the middle. He was a constitutionalist. He wanted to end feudalism. And this is what I want to, you know, just bring up super quickly. People have a hard time believing that. And we saw this, for example, when the fourth Iranian president recently died, Ali Akbar Rafsanjani. Rafsanjani is a guy that people call neoliberal. They call him a neoliberal. This is the president of Iran, post-war period, a revolutionary who has been there from the very beginning. And I just didn't have time to, you know, I didn't want to make this book too long. And when he died, there were millions of people in the streets. And there are even good leftist journalists who you and I know and admire that they called Rafsanjani a neoliberal. It's like, and Rafsanjani is on the right wing of the Iranian, you know, revolutionary spectrum, the progressive revolutionary spectrum. He is more, that makes him more left wing than Bernie Sanders. You know, yeah. It's the exact same thing, I think you'll understand, with as Deng Xiaoping. Calling Deng Xiaoping a right wing guy is totally absurd. He might have been on the right wing of the Chinese revolutionary progressive spectrum, but Deng Xiaoping was a total leftist on the normal political spectrum. You know,
he was still a communist.
I mean, right?
Deng was still a communist.
Exactly. Rafsanjani, still a, you know, Iranian Islamic socialist. Napoleon, still a progressive revolutionary, but he was not a radical leftist like, you know, Robespierre. But yet he was good buddies with Robespierre's brother, and that got him into trouble. I mean, all of these people, they're all revolutionaries, but somehow Napoleon is on the far right, even though he's a revolutionary. Rafsanjani is on the far right, even though he's a revolutionary. Deng Xiaoping is on the far right. It's all nonsense. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thing, you know, because you might remember Rafsanjani died, and people are like, even leftist Western journalists are like, how come there's millions of people mourning his death? And it's like, the dude was a revolutionary. He wasn't a neoliberal. Napoleon wasn't a tyrant. Deng Xiaoping was not a rabid capitalist. You know, it's a different spectrum.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Tell us about, give us just a quick down and dirty on the French Revolution of 1848. This is a lot of history that seeps into the yellow vests.
It really is. I mean, this is where, you know, people don't understand Napoleon, and this is just where the book had to go. I mean, 1848 is so hugely important in Western history, in the history of Europe, that it has to be debunked. And the only thing that people will really kind of know about is that it's the revolutions of 1848. Well, the reality is that they failed everywhere except for France. It's more accurately titled the Counter-Revolutions of 1848. So once again, just like 1789, you know, it, you know, two generations later, France is the only country that is being progressive. They are the only one where the revolution succeeded. And what did they do? They finally re-ended the restoration of unelected monarchy. And that's a huge deal. 1848 is a very, very important deal in that finally in the Germanic areas, in the, you know, Austro-Hungarian Empire, their people finally started to say, we want a constitution, we want rights, we want a complete end to feudalism. And, you know, socialism, you know, by this time is starting to be actually discussed, but it only won in France. So kind of like the Yellow Vests in that they're the only one that had this super sustained anti-austerity protest. This happened in 1871 with the Paris Commune, and this happened in 1848, and this happened in, you know, 1789. So really linking it sort of, you know, all together, you know, the 1848, it becomes so important because we finally end in France unelected monarchy. And then what did they start? They started with the Second Republic, a continuation of the French Revolutionary Republic. And it's the first time that what I call Western liberal democracy is finally implemented, And, you know, you have to read the book, but, you know, 1848 in France should be a huge success. Everybody should know about it, you know, given that we're in, you know, when we are in the West, we are in liberal democratic countries. Everybody should know about it. Nobody knows anything about it because it was such a huge failure. And this is what Marx proved with his, you know, phenomenal writings, you know, on France, that the Second Republic, it took 3 years for people to realize that, wait a minute, liberal democracy is terrible. This is an oligarchy. This is an aristocracy. They're not trying to, you know, help the people at all. This is mostly ex-monarchists who are controlling the government. And this liberal democracy is just, what the problems we're talking about, you know, in Western democracies today are the same as they were in 1848. So, you know, the Yellow Vests are asking for things that they've been asking for in France since 1848. And that's why, you know, I had to really sort of, you know, make this link. And then the ultimate irony is for me is that people are talking about how, you know, that the French are so bad in the 19th century. But then you look at who won in 1848. It's these extreme autocrats, these extreme censors, this extreme repression. And the guy, the most important figure of this era for the next 25 years is Napoleon Bonaparte's nephew, Louis Napoleon Bonaparte. And nobody outside of France knows who he is, but he's so important and you have to read the book because, and I'm going to make it real quick because I feel like I'm just talking too much, but just it explains how, like his uncle, he took a revolutionary road that was more centrist. He defended the right to universal suffrage and he defended the Constitution, the idea that the Constitution cannot be subverted by a liberal democratic oligarchical parliament, which is exactly what parliament is in a liberal democracy. And between 1848 and 1851, this new liberal democratic parliament, they voted to subvert the Constitution to their votes in parliament. This is a parliament that's totally, you know, rich people. And they voted to gut universal suffrage, which was the main universal male suffrage, which was the main concept of 1848. This expansion of no power has to go from a absolute monarch and his coterie to at least all men. And now, you know, we are in a place where people 18 and over, you know, people, you know, women, everybody, you know, refugees, immigrants, they all have to have a say in how, you know, their taxes, you know, get spent. So, you know, we talk, you know, my book talks, you know, often about this because the Second Republic, 1848 to 1852, when Louis Napoleon committed what's known as an auto coup against Parliament, and he was elected emperor in 1852, when he is elected emperor, he's still the only elected monarch. So like his uncle, we see how slow history is moving. We see how powerful monarchy is, which Iranians knew in 1978. You know, monarchies are still so powerful today. Saudi Arabia, Morocco, the Queen of England, these are all relics of a bygone era. You know, we have to have democracy. And this is what 1848 talks about. And it's just, it's really, really so interesting. So it's kind of the same thing. If anybody brings up Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, that he was a tyrant, you just tell them the same thing about what you can tell them about Napoleon Bonaparte. He was elected. He was elected emperor, and this is a huge, huge difference compared with his peers. So the main thing here is really to just, read Marx on France, and he breaks it all down. But what I draw the parallel to is, the liberal democracy of today is the same problems that he saw 175 years ago.
And then we moved to the Paris Commune. I was really shocked, to learn that the Germans helped slaughter 30,000 communards, 30,000 revolutionaries. I was also shocked to see that it was the same playbook as in the 20th century, totalitarian repression, violence against the people, absolute control of the media and propaganda, newspapers shut down, fake news, everything else. Please tell us why 1871 happened and why it is so important to Europe's dire straits today, because you kind of make a connection from 1871 up to the later into the book, which we'll do it in the second half about the European Commission. Go ahead.
Yeah, the Paris Commune, I think everybody has heard of it, but very few people really understand it. And I think that we have the EU and the repression of the Yellow Vests is very, very similar to the Paris Commune, and it's a bookend. 1871 is the real start of neoliberalism. Liberalism had been kicked out by Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, sanctioned by a popular vote that wouldn't be reached in most of the rest of Europe until after World War I, so it's democratically approved. But then in 1871, you have the oligarchs of France conspiring with Bismarck, with the Prussians, with the Germans, and they lay siege to Paris for four months in order to prevent socialist democratic ideas from spreading. By 1871, they knew that absolute monarchy was bad. They had learned by 1852 that liberal democracy was just another oligarchy. And then by 1871, they realized that Bonapartism, which is something that had run all the way from 1815 until now, Bonapartism was not a middle road, and that socialist democracy is the only thing that's going to give policy influence to the working poor. And that connects us to the Yellow Vests. That's what the Yellow Vests want. They are the working poor, and they want some influence in policy making. And they were championing that in 1871. Instead, we had a multinational European force with domestic traitors conspiring to wipe out more people in the Paris Commune than were killed in the terror of the French Revolution. This is something that liberal democracy cannot talk about because it's so obviously treachery. It's so obviously collusion. It's so obviously the domination of aristocracy. But it's really the start of neoliberalism. That's when liberalism was imposed. And what I do is I draw the parallel between 1871, how it's this multinational European 1% that is repressing progressive politics in France. That's 1871 Paris Commune. And then starting in 2018 with the Yellow Vests, you have a multinational force repressing progressive politics in France and Greece and Spain and everywhere, but it's called the EU. So the Paris Commune is really the start of a liberal democratic project based around a European 1%. That's what it was. And it's just so absolutely shocking. And, you know, so, you know, I think leftists know why the Paris Commune is so important, even if the average person doesn't know. But can you make, can you see the link between the these this 1% liberal democracy of 1871 and the liberal democratic project of the European Union? That's what this book, I think, you know, hopefully kind of, you know, makes clear. And, you know, as somebody who has been a daily hard news reporter from France ever since the installation of the European project, undemocratically, as we all know, with the Lisbon Treaty in 2009, and I've been reporting from France and watching the EU fail, and then seeing the yellow vest repressed, it really shows, you know, and this is what a lot of people have been very sort of excited about by this book. It emphatically says liberal democracy is a failure. And I'm just repeating what Marx saw in 1849, 50, and 51. I'm just repeating, you know, what we saw with the Paris Commune. And then we have, of course, World War I is a failure of democracy. Liberal democracy. The Great Depression is a failure of liberal democracy to reflect the needs of the working poor class. World War II is a failure of liberal democracy. And, you know, then we had the only time liberal democracy has ever worked is 1945 to 1975, and that's because liberal democracy was so discredited by the bloodletting of World War I and World War II and the Great Depression that they had to put in some social democratic ideas. In 1945 to 1975 is known as the 30 Glorious Years in France, and that's when unions were at their height. That's when workers' rights, that's when, you know, flourished. That's when women finally got the right to vote. But now, with what we are calling neoliberalism, starting in the late 70s, Reaganism, Thatcherism, but it's really, as I point out, it's the third imposition of liberalism, because the second one was in 1871. We are seeing how social democracy is being rolled back, and that's what the yellow vests are really fighting against. The yellow vests, and we can talk about this in part two, they're not socialist democratic revolutionaries. Like, you know, socialist inspired, like in Iran, like in China, like in Cuba, you know, they want mere social democracy, but this is, it's very important to sort of realize that liberal democracy will never even give you that. And Marx pointed that out in France in 1850. We saw that in 1871, the lengths that even the French elite, much like Macron, will go to repress their own people. They will collude with foreign, with, you know, troops of, you know, Prussian troops, Germanic troops. I mean, it's so obvious, you know, when we look at it, how the EU is the elite of Paris and the elite of Germany conspiring to repress the working poor class, to repress the yellow vest, to repress progressive politics. So I think that this book, by going through the history from 1789 to today, it really makes it clear that liberal democracy is a failure, and it always will be. And Marx said the same thing back in 1848.
You really hit it on the mark, and I've been saying the same thing myself, you know, for the last couple of years. The more I learn about Western, quote, democracy, Western liberal democracy, you know, I just see that it is a complete and total sham. And it is still the same, you know, what I call the trillionaire dictatorship, you know, pulling the strings, making all the decisions, buying off judges, buying off legislatures, rubber stamp legislatures. It's totally ignoring the wishes of the people, totally ignoring. That's why they don't want any referenda, because if they had referenda, they might actually have to. Charles de Gaulle had referenda, but he's one of the last ones. And it's very, very undemocratic, and it's very, very aristocratic and elitist and autocratic, and now it's becoming, with all that's happened in the last few years, it's becoming totalitarian with all the repression.
I totally hear you. You know, one thing that really surprised me when I was writing this book is how anti-EU, how pan-Europe, how anti-pan-European project it had to be. Did I convince you? Did my portrayal of the Yellow Vest, you know, convince you that this pan-European project has failed to bring prosperity, stability, and democracy?
Absolutely, and now the national leaders are basically have to answer to Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum and the Rothschilds. And we'll do that in the second half, where you talk about the European group, which I never even knew existed. But that'll be in the second half. Listen, Ramin, this has been a wonderful conversation. I will post his book links. And again, the book we talked about today is his book about the Yellow Vests, which I just really, really loved. And then I have not read it yet, but we will actually do one, and that's on the Islamic Socialist Revolution in Iran. And as Ramin has told me 100 times, Iran is socialist first and Islamic second. You know, that was the priority.
Well, now, wait a minute, Jeff, it's, you know, I chose the name very carefully. It's Iranian first. It's all about Iran. It's patriotic. It's Islamic second. You know, Khomeini said that the needs of Iran have to come before the needs of Islam. So it's actually Islamic second. And then it's socialist third. It's socialist inspired. 1917. You know, 1949,
1979. Okay, I thought the people came second. I thought that was the socialist part.
So oh, I mean, this was a big debate that they had in, you know, the 1980s, that which comes first, Islam or the nation? And they decided openly, democratically, the nation.
Okay, very good. And then his first book, I'll Ruin Everything You Are, Ending Western Propaganda on Red China. And another wonderful book, which I really enjoyed reading. Thank you, Ramin. I will have you back for part two, and we will pick up from 1871 up until 2022.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and we'll get something scheduled here in the next few days after we get this one digested. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.